Hello, listeners. Today is Wednesday, May 18th. Welcome to Behind the Numbers, Reimagining Retail, an e-marketer podcast made possible by mParticle. This is the show where we talk about how retail collides with every part of our lives. I'm your new host, Sarah Lebo. Three things you need to know about me. I prefer stores to e-commerce. I keep saying I'm going to stop shopping on Amazon, and then I buy another thing. And my first retail-related job was at a gelato shop in Michigan. On this episode, we'll be discussing direct-to-consumer brands, where they started, what they're up to now, and where they're headed. I'm joined by retail analyst and D2C expert Andrew Lipsman. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Sarah. Great to be with you in your debut episode.
Great to be with you in your debut episode in the guest seat. How does it feel?
Feels great to get back to it. How does it feel to be in the host seat?
It feels fine to be in the host seat. You know, feels like any other seat. It's nicer than my normal chair, so. All right, well, we're going to jump right in with our first segment. Our first segment is called News and Reviews, where I give the news and our guest tells me their reviews. Andrew, today I'm going to give you a headline and you're going to talk about your review. Today's news comes at us from CNBC, and it is online grocery delivery platform Instacart confidentially files for IPO in the US. Andrew, what's your review on Instacart confidentially filing for IPO?
I think it's great. You know, there's been a lot of will they, won't they in terms of filing for an IPO. Obviously, there has been a lot of turmoil over the last year as the pandemic boom has subsided and what that meant for Instacart's prospects on the public markets. I'm frankly a little bit surprised that they're doing it, but I think it's a good thing. Surprised because the markets have turned south and it doesn't seem like there's a lot of companies that are looking to IPO. So to me, that's a sign of strength that Instacart knows that there is strength in their platform. I do believe they're a mature enough company. Hopefully this also means for them that the growth numbers are looking more reasonable. And yeah, I think this is a company that ultimately is ready for public markets, even though, you know, it may meet the public markets with maybe not the big boom that they're hoping for.
Yeah, honestly, I was a little surprised by this one. I feel like as a consumer of news, every headline I see about Instacart right now is negative. So it's a little surprising, but I know that you have confidence in some of the places they're exploring right now. Hope to talk to you about that some other time on the podcast. But yeah, I mean, clearly Instacart has confidence as well.
Yep, as well they should be. And yeah, I think you and I will have a deeper dive on this topic in the coming weeks.
All right, so let's jump into our topic for today. It's time for Retail Me This, Retail Me That, where we discuss an interesting retail concept. So today we're talking about one of your favorite concepts, D2C. It's also one of my favorite concepts as a millennial, as a connoisseur of D2C. I woke up this morning in what I call my podcast sheets, which are my Brooklinen sheets I heard about on a podcast. I used my podcast toothbrush. That's my quip. Now I'm here recording my podcast. Let's dive in.
On the same day that we are reimagining retail.
So we're looking at some data from the report you wrote on D2C e-commerce in 2022. In your report, you noted that direct-to-consumer e-commerce sales will total over $150 billion in the U.S. this year. You said that about 75% of that will come from established brands, and the other 25% will come from digitally native brands. So my question for you, what's the difference? What's the difference between an established brand and a digitally native brand? Who's who?
Sure. Well, so the D2C brand movement really started, you know, 10 or so years ago, and it's come to the forefront over the last few years. When we think of D2C brands, we often use that term interchangeably with digitally native vertical brands or DNVBs. So those two things have traditionally been synonymous. But at the same time, we've also seen the emergence of established brands who have been around for a long time, actively trying to sell direct to consumer. In other words, not through traditional retail channels. So there's a lot of major brands, whether that's Nike, Lululemon, Crocs, Levi's, brands like that. And these are already big established brands and they're able to sell a lot more through their owned and operated channels, either their .com site or in some cases their own retail stores. So I think we need to start thinking about the D2C space with these two separate segments in mind. And there are a lot of interesting things that are happening with those two segments, and some of it's kind of counterintuitive.
So the digitally native brands are my podcast brands, the brands I'm hearing about on my podcast. And the established brands are when I Google Adidas white sneakers everyone else is wearing, where can I get them?
That's exactly right. And hopefully for Adidas's sake, when you do that search, it's going to direct you right to adidas.com.
You know what? It did. And then I got on the train and I went to DSW and I bought my shoes from there. So directed me in the right spot. Sorry, Adidas, you didn't get the conversion from me.
Yeah, but right, that's the transaction they're after, because when it goes to their .com, all of that margin that they usually cough up to the retailer, they get to keep for themselves. So the question is, why are established brands going to D2C strategies? A big, big part of it comes down to profits, right? If you are a brand that consumers want, that they will go after, and that they don't rely on that brand being put in front of them when they're walking the aisles in a store, it's to their advantage to start to migrate some of those transactions from those traditional retailers into their own coffers, because it drops to the bottom line, makes them more profitable. And it's really a sweet spot to drive the growth of that business and the valuation of that business.
That makes sense. So you wrote in your report that D2C sales will account for 1 in 7 e-commerce dollars this year. Why D2C? What has changed in the market?
Yeah, I mean, I think the emergence of the whole D2C movement really comes down to digital. Digital has changed everything. That's an overly simplistic answer. So really, if you think about the way that brands made their way to consumers through the path to purchase in the past, there's a whole value chain, a media value chain. It sort of begins with content, where you might see a brand or experience that brand. And that content, let's think of it in terms of linear TV or print. Those are kind of the traditional channels. And then you had to distribute the content through those channels. And back in the old model, really, that distribution mechanism was very physical and capital intensive, whether it required a printing press or laying down cable. Then that media that happened on TV or print reached audiences. Those audiences really, by virtue of the mass media channels, they had to be mass large audiences. So this was traditionally like 18 to 34 year old females.
That's me.
And then finally, those audiences would respond and buy a product or brand that they liked in the physical store. Right. So this was kind of a long path to purchase, and there were a lot of constraints around it. Today, we're living in this new digital model where the content itself is not static. It's not bundled. It's very dynamic. It's digital. It's atomized. The distribution is digital. So it's very asset light. And basically through the internet, on streaming video, social media, all the different ways that you see content, you're delivered with ads. And those ads reach audiences, but they don't have to be a mass audience. They can be very niche, very interest-based. And ultimately, you can target a small subset of consumers who might like your brand, and then they can transact, but they don't have to do it in physical stores. They can also do it via e-commerce. So if you think about that whole path to purchase, in some cases, it's as simple as you see a new brand on Instagram, you like the visual, and you immediately click and buy it right on Instagram, right? In theory, it can happen in just a matter of seconds. So that whole value chain has collapsed, and you potentially have a really short path to purchase. What it also means is the barriers to entry are lower than they've ever been. So that's why you've had this flood of D2C brands who feel like with, shoestring budgets in the beginning, that they've got a brand that's going to resonate and they can get it off the ground quickly.
So in your report, you mentioned D2C as an over-the-top strategy. To me, over-the-top is a TV term. It refers to streaming and media. What does over-the-top mean in a D2C context?
Yeah, I mean, so the over-the-top terminology that you hear in TV is really because it's digital distribution that goes over the top of the cable bundle, right? So it's the way that this new model kind of overtakes the old model. But you see it across a lot of different areas of business today. It's not just in media and TV. You see it happening in finance, where the traditional gatekeepers there were institutional investors and actively managed funds. And now you can just buy an ETF that's all bundled nicely for you, and you don't have to pay those extra fees. Politics, if you think about, in the past, who became presidential candidates, it was the party decides. You had this party apparatus that kind of put their thumb on the scales to determine who they would present to voters to be their constituents. All of a sudden, you have celebrities who are coming into politics like Donald Trump, and he has certainly gone over the top of the traditional party apparatus to win votes from voters.
I feel like there's an obvious parallel there. Like, with Donald Trump. He became president essentially through using Twitter. Who else is using Twitter a lot and has a D2C? Elon Musk literally went over the top by buying Twitter. Is that, do you feel like that's a correct parallel?
Absolutely, right? He also has learned how to use Twitter effectively, engage in very over-the-top rhetoric. His model, even though Tesla is technically an established brand, it's a newer brand, but it's still an established brand. You know, what he's been able to do is bypass the traditional intermediaries in the car buying process, car dealerships, by bringing showrooms directly to consumers, bringing his brand directly to consumers. Doesn't advertise Tesla, by the way. He's able to kind of use the cult of personality surrounding him to get plenty of attention so that Teslas are frankly oversubscribed in terms of consumer demand. So yeah, absolutely. He's a great example of going over the top.
Yeah, I also used the cult of personality to sell a car when I sold my Subaru to my cousin by saying, hey, would you like my car? I have an extra one. As I moved to New York. What other brands beyond Tesla are using the D2C playbook effectively?
Yeah, well, we can't talk about the D2C playbook without talking about who I consider the OG of D2C, and that's Dollar Shave Club. I'll never forget the moment that I saw Dollar Shave Club's first original viral video commercial that was distributed on YouTube. By the way, it was created for about $4,500. And it used Michael Dubin, who is the CEO and founder of it, and a very tongue-in-cheek ad that basically went after Gillette as the industry incumbent. And it was over the top in sort of being tongue-in-cheek. It was very funny. It was very fresh. It was different. And, you know, what I think resonated about it so well was everybody knew there was this kind of intuition that everybody pays too much for blades and they keep shoving more and more blades in my face and they keep charging more. And it's $20, it's behind lock and key, and it's a pain just to get a razor blade.
Literally behind lock and key because you cannot get them at a CVS without asking someone to unlock them.
Right? It couldn't be a more friction-filled buying process for something that you already feel like you're getting swindled on. So perfect reason to go over the top and buy online. So Dollar Shave Club saw that opportunity. They exploited it. They reached the audience of younger male shavers to start, you know, hawking a cheaper product. They said, you don't need to pay for five blades. You don't need to pay for Roger Federer to endorse it. Just come buy a three-blade razor. It's going to do just as good of a job and you're going to pay, you know, half as much. And it worked. It helped that brand get off the ground.
I don't doubt that the ad was effective. Looking at it now, it feels deeply 2012. I rewatched it for this. There's a dancing bear.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of music breaks. Who else is using it effectively?
So I think the early playbook, really some similar brands, not similar in tone per se, but they did the same thing in sort of going after these monopolistic industry incumbents where people were basically overpaying. Warby Parker. Right. You have Luxottica.
Sure.
Had a huge, huge share of the market. People knew they were, why am I paying $300, $400 for a pair of glasses? Warby Parker came in and undersold them with the right aesthetic for you know, millennials at $99 at the original price point. Casper mattresses, huge profits in mattresses. People didn't know this. And Casper came in and said, why is mattress buying have to be such a lifeless experience? Let's wrap mattresses in a better brand, make it easier for people to get it into their apartments and sell it at a much cheaper price. So those to me are kind of like the original segment of ones that really ran this playbook effectively to get those brands off the ground in an effective way.
Okay, so we talked about these brands. Sure, a lot of them are still around. What are the limits of the D2C strategy?
I think what's good in being able to get a brand off the ground, the low barriers to entry, it's all good, right? And many brands can have success getting up to, let's say, $10 million in sales. But the strategy only takes a brand so far. I think that the rhetoric, you know, has a lifespan to it, and it's not going to take a brand to the next level. The benefits of cutting out the middleman, I think a lot of that erodes over time. The early arbitrage opportunity of selling these brands through social ads, it's just dried up. So there's a lot more competition. So another thing is it works really well when you have a clear villain with some of these monopolies to go after. A lot of D2C, frankly, it's in lifestyle brands, you know, apparel. I don't know who the big apparel brands are that you can effectively attack as the incumbents. There's examples here. Third Love went after Victoria's Secret. But across most of the spectrum, I don't think it works that well. So a lot of these early tactics that worked have just run out of gas. And I think what you're left with at the end of the day is for the brand to grow, you have to have the quality of the brand. So Does that brand have a second act? Does that brand ultimately have staying power and something that's differentiated and meaningful to consumers?
Andrew, I want to talk more with you about brands that can grow and how they're growing and who's sticking around. But first, we get to hear from our sponsor, mParticle.
At the end of the day, your customer has to be at the center of everything you do. This starts with the right customer data strategy, as well as the right foundation to solve the challenges that typically inhibit success, such as data quality, data governance, and connectivity. mParticle is your real-time customer data infrastructure that helps you accelerate your data strategy by cleansing, visualizing, and integrating your customer data from anywhere to anywhere. Ultimately, better data leads to better decisions, better customer experiences, and better outcomes. See why the best brands choose mParticle. Go to www.mParticle.com.
Welcome back from the break, Andrew, and also listeners. Now it's time for pop-up rankings, where we take a look at specific examples and we, you guessed it, we rank them. Andrew, we talked a lot about D2C strategies. I want to get prescriptive now. What D2Cs are going to endure in the digital age?
Yeah, well, I spent a lot of time thinking about this. What's interesting as a backdrop to this is that many of the D2C brands who have grown up to some extent, a lot of them are now public companies. Many of them have billion-dollar valuations. They too have endured some tough headlines. The growth that everybody once expected isn't necessarily there. The profitability isn't there. All that said, I do think that we have seen some brands come out of this movement that I believe are absolutely going to be enduring brands in the digital age. I think they've kind of gotten to that, you know, it's always tough. Maybe there's an easy first act, a little bit tougher second act to kind of find that growth, and then a third act where I think the brands really establish themselves and put themselves on a trajectory to grow. They may not be the most massive brands at the end of the day, but they will be enduring and meaningful brands. So I'll do my countdown. So the first one, number five, and I'm already cheating on my ranking here. I'm going to lump two of them into my number five, and that is Harry's and Quip.
That works for me because I am a customer of both of those companies.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, what do you like about them or why do you use them?
Okay, Andrew, my deep, dark secret, what I like about Harry's. I'm just going to tell you this. Don't tell anyone. I like Harry's because someone who used to live in my apartment still gets his Harry's razors delivered to my apartment. So let this be a note for subscription-based models. Still works if you forget about it. I've texted him and said I'm getting his razors. He hasn't done anything about it. So I use the men's Harry's razors and they work really well.
Subscription model. And inertia is a powerful force, right?
Absolutely. Quip, honestly, I'm doing the same thing. I'm just the one paying for it. I'm not super sold on Quip anymore. I bought a Quip at a Target, so in a retail space, about 4 years ago. And it's my toothbrush now because, I don't know, I bought it and I signed up. So I guess I keep using it.
Can I tell you what I like about Quip? So I'm a user of both of these brands too. And one of the things that they both have in common, they're personal care brands. They, I think, have really kind of started to own their respective segments of personal care. They went into Target and other big, you know, brick and mortar retailers, but there was visibility for these brands and it wasn't just on Subway ads. So they really grew the brand and grew awareness. And they were brands well-designed for the modern age and younger consumers. For me, Quip, I have to say the biggest thing was I always wanted an electric toothbrush. My wife had Sonicare and I hated that the Sonicare was built with this fat handle to be built around one of the big batteries.
It's also a $200 toothbrush.
But it was just awkward. I would have paid for it for something I use every day. It was awkward to hold. So the Quip, it just had this sleek handle. So I was like, oh, great. Okay, now I don't have to feel awkward while I'm brushing my teeth and I get the vibration. So it was simple there. But I think these are brands that did it the right way. They went into brick and mortar at the right time. And now they've built, you know, pretty big brands and they seem to be growing nicely.
As someone with very weak arms, it works for me. Andrew, give me number four.
So number four is The Honest Company.
Yes, Jessica Alba. Is that who it is?
That's Jessica Alba, yeah. So I think she was really ahead of trend here.
I think she was ahead of trend when she recorded Honey.
Oh, yeah.
Filmed Honey. Great movie.
Can't say that I've seen that one. But
it's excellent. She dances.
This was a great second act for her with this company, which quickly became a billion-dollar brand. But what it got right was recognizing there was a whole segment of consumers, it was millennials, earlier days of millennials, as they were forming households. And they just did not want these toxic products as their household products. They wanted brands that use clean ingredients. And it was just a massive consumer opportunity that was waiting to happen. There was already a segment of consumers who were ready for it, but the whole age group really grew into this. And so there was just a big market there. And she aligned around that trend. And to me, it's a no-brainer. It's a great company.
And you're absolutely right that she needed a second act because she was not in Honey 2. They cast someone else in that.
Yeah, so. I'm not sure the acting career really, really went anywhere, did it?
Let's not be rude to Jessica Alba on my podcast.
I still like her. I still like her.
Jessica Alba, if you're listening, we're fans. Andrew, give me number three.
So number three is Away, the travel luggage brand. I think, once again, it tapped into a new consumer that was emerging, right? We had the millennial consumer, Gen Z consumer, who, as we always hear, the cliche that they like to spend their money on experiences over things. Well, they like to travel. Much of it is shared through Instagram and other social media. And so there's a cachet around that. And Away understood, you know, luggage was boring. You had your parents' brands and the next generation wasn't really that interested in them. They also recognized some customer insights around how people wanted to travel. Like everybody has this issue with charging anxiety when they're traveling. And so Away did little things like building in charging stations into people's luggage. So they just...
Yeah, except now the luggage person always asks if you have a battery built into right. your suitcase.
It did cause some problems after the fact. But I thought it was genius to understand and realize the importance of that and just how big of a driver that could be for people. And then the luggage is very identifiable, right? It became this kind of millennial status symbol.
It's a status symbol for sure. I used to travel for work and all the cool people had Away bags.
So it just kind of, it rejuvenated a category for a large segment of consumers. It created relevance. And I don't think that relevance is going away. And even though the brand had some stumbles, they had some CEO controversy. They also obviously had a really tough time in the pandemic when everyone's completely stopped traveling. They've been able to bounce back. So I think this is a brand that's, you know, it's been tested and it's going to endure.
The workplace controversy they faced earlier, they really shook that.
Yeah, I think most of these brands can't, right? You can, PR, it doesn't feel good in the moment when you have a PR crisis, but most of these brands can get past it. And actually, in one of our last ones, we'll talk about a brand that has also incurred some of that.
Oh, I'm interested. First, we have to talk about number two.
Number two, one of the OGs, Warby Parker.
Warby Parker. I'm going to let the listeners in on a little secret. I know I sound like I have 20/20 vision. No, I'm actually sitting here wearing Warby Parker glasses. I don't love Warby Parker glasses, but I'm on my third pair, even though they keep breaking, because I know exactly how much they're going to cost. I know how it works, so I go to Warby Parker.
I'm the same way. I have to say, they're not like amazing quality glasses, but you know what? I break glasses and I lose glasses. So yeah. I don't need to spend more than $100 because I'm going to be doing it with some regularity. I thought the first time that I did the try-on process with Warby was genius. I was like, wait a second, you're just going to send me these frames. I can try them all on. I don't have to go, you know, to the store. And
I'm a brick and mortar girl.
Yeah, you're going to measure the, you know, the distance between my pupils so that you can give me the frames that will fit my face the best. And it worked. And I found a good frame that I liked. I bought a couple pairs since then. And, you know, again, speaking to a new generation of consumers, I think the whole ethos, I mean, they really were a big part of that early hipster millennial ethos. They were stylish. And I have to say, sometimes like a great brand name goes a long way. I've loved the name Warby Parker from the outset. It's always sounded like a character from a J.D. Salinger novel. It just works. The brand just works.
Do you know where it comes from? I don't know where it comes from.
I've read this at some point. I think they took parts of two characters' names from some literature, if I'm remembering correctly, but I may be misremembering.
Honestly, the Warby Parker in any Warby Parker has like pretty wild vibes. The art is so bright and confusing, but I'm still going there and buying glasses, so clearly it's working. Okay, you hinted at number one before by saying it was a brand with controversy, so I'm running through my head thinking of the most controversial brands I can think of. I'm not going to say them. I'm just going to let you tell me what you think is the number one brand that will survive the digital age.
Yep. And I love the fact that it has incurred so much controversy more than any of these other brands maybe combined. And they've had a number of PR crises that they've had to navigate through over the years. And I still think they're going to come through it as one of the true power brands of this generation. And that's Peloton. Peloton. Again, it was a great brand a very aspirational brand from the outset, right? And you only see these brands come along every so often, but when you see them, you really respond to it. You see other people responding to it. And I look at it very much in the same way that I think Nike captured that zeitgeist and Lululemon captured that zeitgeist. Peloton has really created a category that, while it was a pandemic darling and has since come off of those highs, you know, connected fitness isn't going anywhere. People can't buy these expensive bikes, you know, every year for sure,
yeah.
Which means that the brand has to evolve. And I think, you know, so the question, does it have a second or third act? And I would say absolutely yes. Peloton still has cachet. It has an apparel brand that I think, mm-hmm. you know, can be ultimately maybe the next biggest after Lululemon in the athleisure space. They have brand ambassadors who are
celebrities, micro celebrities.
Yeah, celebrities wearing the apparel every day.
Having their weddings covered in tabloids. Like they sure have that. Peloton's another company that, like, every headline is like Peloton's terrible quarter. They had so much growth. Obviously, it can't keep up. I don't see them going anywhere either. And I'm not even a Peloton person.
It had to catch up with itself, right? It becomes a victim of the really insane spike that it had during 2020. So now things are just rationalizing, and they've brought in, obviously, you know, how the company was run. They needed to get more operationally efficient. They brought in a professional CEO who knows what he's doing. So it's going to take a little while for him to work out the kinks, no doubt. But what endures here as they figure out, you know, the business and how to make it profitable and realize its potential, that happens behind the scenes. In front of the scenes, it's still built an incredible brand that people are engaging with an unbelievable amount, and they're expanding. My wife, you know, we don't have a Peloton in our house. My wife has started using the Peloton app for workouts and she absolutely loves it. So I think that media experience is such a great way to onboard people into buyers of the very high margin equipment.
Andrew, thank you for walking me through those top five. I'm going to cool down from this Peloton conversation. If you want to read more about what Andrew talked about today, you can check out eMarketer.com for Andrew's D2C 2022 report. It's good. I read it twice. Andrew, thanks for joining me in the guest seat today.
Thanks, Sarah. It's great to be here.
Thank you to our listeners. And thank you, Victoria, who edits the podcast. I will see you next week for another episode of Reimagining Retail, an eMarketer podcast made possible by mParticle. And you can tune in tomorrow. Marcus will be back for another Behind the Numbers Daily and eMarketer podcast. Thanks.